from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As Côte d'Ivoire inches closer to its first elections since the removal at gunpoint of President Laurent Gbagbo by French troops after the elections of 2010, the government of Alassane Ouattara is being criticized for corruption and for failing to protect the country from renewed instability. Since taking power in 2011, the Ouattara government has been dogged by accusations of carrying out selective justice in response to the clashes which have killed at least 3,000 people in the past 3 years. The bulk of those detained for crimes related to the violence have been supporters of his ousted rival, the former president. The next presidential elections are set for October of this year. In a recently issued report on the situation in the West African nation, the UN Secretary General has called on all sides to work together for a peaceful and transparent election. Derek Mbata reports from the United Nations.
All stakeholders in Côte d'Ivoire are being urged to work together towards the holding of a peaceful, constructive, and efficient election for the benefit of all Ivorians. The appeal is contained in the UN Secretary General's report on the UN operation in the country, UNOSI, which is being discussed by the Security Council on Tuesday. The West African country is recovering from the 2011 political crisis sparked by a dispute over the presidential runoff elections. In his report, the Secretary General says Côte d'Ivoire continues to make progress on the path to reconciliation, normalization, and economic recovery. At the same time, the Secretary General expresses his deep concern over the resurgence of inflammatory speech, in particular with regard to election-related matters. Mr. Ban points out that, given the importance of the 2015 election, the UN should respond positively to the request from Ivorian authorities for electoral assistance. He requests the Security Council to expand UNOSI's mandate to allow it to support the electoral process. Derek Mbata, United Nations.
Attacks on Muslims and their property have escalated in the past days in France after last week's attack on a French magazine's headquarters. RT's Rory Suchet has more.
France is suffering a wave of hate attacks against Muslims in the wake of last week's extremist attacks in and around Paris. Monitors of Islamophobia are reporting scores of incidents. In fact, since Wednesday, there have been over 20 shootings at Islamic buildings, even grenades as well. On top of that, there have been over 30 threats made. In fact, overall, 54 anti-Muslim incidents now in less than the course of a week. Now, in just the first 2 days after the shooting at the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, over a dozen attacks against Muslims were registered all throughout the country. In fact, an assault, for example, on a mosque in the city of Le Mans, that was one of them. Three grenades were thrown into the building. Let's show you another incident in the southeast of France. A bomb detonated near a Muslim restaurant as well. And in another city in the same region, a mosque there was actually set on fire. So concern is coursing through the Muslim community. There's little security to protect them, as RT's Harry Fear now reports.
In the wake of the devastating terror attacks of last week, Paris has been promised additional security from the French state. We understand between 5 and 15,000 additional police or troops are going to be deployed at hundreds of key sites, including Jewish schools, to beef up security. Well, this is the Grand Mosque in central Paris, and there is currently zero security to provide this historic and significant Muslim site.
We say in French, deux poids, deux mesures. It means sometimes you protect a lot of a community or you do a lot of things for them, and for another community, it's not the same. And many people are asking for more equality between the communities.
in summer 2013 in the UK context, following the slaying of the British soldier in London. There was a massive spike in anti-Muslim violence. The fear that something similar could transpire here.
We actually have been asking for many years through the states that they secure Muslim location, especially the mosques, as they actually do for Jewish locations such as synagogues. So I believe that today more than ever we will need this security around Muslim locations.
There have been more than 50 attacks against Muslims in France since the attacks took place on Wednesday. In the coming days, weeks and months, the French Republic will be judged on how it provides security for its vulnerable minority communities. However, for some, already, ostensibly, the French state is failing to do so. In Paris, I'm Harry Fear, RT.
Well, French Muslims are admitting they are afraid of a possible escalation. The head of the Collective Against Islamophobia in France admitted that he's scared for his family. Asghar Bukhari, a founding member of the Muslim Public Affairs Committee UK, a warning against demonising all Muslims because of extremist attacks.
You have this belief that Muslims are in the know. They must have known about the attack. These 6 million people secretly knew about it. They don't know about it. Often even the parents of the of people who are going to take some sort of terrorist attack have no knowledge of what's going to go on. So, I never really understand what people want us to do. As far as the institutions, the Muslim mosques and stuff, I suppose they could do something in that they could teach young Muslims that they could bring about a change to the frustrations, policies that the Western world is committing around the Muslim world. But, even that is a false start because they can't talk about foreign policy. They're so frightened that the government might come down and call them extremists because of it.
Now, anti-Islamic sentiment is growing in Germany as well. Last night, 25,000 rallied in Dresden, defying the government's calls not to attend the controversial event. In fact, the organizers of the group Pegida are accused of inciting hatred against refugees and foreigners. There were also rival rallies held across Germany, reportedly dwarfing the Dresden demonstration. Asghar Bukhari believes overall European authorities and their attempts to crush terror are actually making things worse.
The fact of the matter is the government in France is just covering for the fact, as many governments in Europe, that their war of terror is creating extremism, and they're blaming and covering themselves by saying that they're standing up for free speech. They're not standing up for free speech. They've been snooping on their own citizens for years and arresting them for it. The fact of the matter is it's a war of terror. It's radicalization and extremism off the back of the war of terror, and they don't want their own public to know about it.
Good news for the former U.S.-backed dictator of Egypt. That country's high court has overturned the only remaining conviction against former President Hosni Mubarak and ordered a retrial in his embezzlement case. The ruling could pave the way for Mubarak to be released from jail. We have this report from CCTV.
The ruling could pave the way for Mubarak to be released from jail. Mubarak was sentenced to 3 years in jail in May for stealing public funds to renovate family properties. He's been serving that sentence in a military hospital in Cairo. Now that a retrial has been ordered, officials say Mubarak could walk free, as no convictions against him remain. In November, another court cleared the former Egyptian leader in two other corruption cases. It also dropped charges against him for conspiring to kill protesters in the 2011 uprising that removed Mubarak from power.
Meanwhile, the news is not so good for Egyptians, mostly Bedouins, living in the Sinai, where more evacuations and home demolitions have begun. Press TV's Karim Gamal El-Dean reports from Cairo.
Egypt has expanded operations as part of the second phase in its effort to create a buffer zone in the Egyptian side of Rafah bordering Gaza. The first phase of the operation started back in October, following a terrorist attack which took the lives of 30 security personnel. The first phase of the buffer zone stretches 13.5 kilometers long and 500 meters in width, parallel to the border with Gaza. It was carried out with the evacuation of 1,156 families. The second phase is set to cover another 500 meters. This requires even further evacuations and demolitions of houses. While some hail the move as necessary to secure Egypt's Sinai, many have raised concerns over the strategy regarding the fate of the displaced families.
These people are literally snatched out of their houses, forced out of their houses, and the houses get demolished, exploded. They may spend some weeks and some months in this terrible weather that we haven't seen for decades. They spend that on the street, not even a street, it's in the desert, literally in the midst of the desert. Some may even die without any kind of concern for a human soul or anything of the sort.
The Egyptian government hopes to end all tunnel activity along the border and to limit militant operations in the Sinai Peninsula, which has cost security forces tens of fatalities over the last year. The Egyptian government is hopeful its strategy will work, and officials were quoted saying that militants have already moved a large part of their operations from Sinai to Libya. Sources have said that the buffer zone may expand to fully include all of Rafah, with its 11 villages and 75,000 residents. Egypt has been struggling with a serious militancy problem over the last year, but many are wondering if the buffer zone is going to be enough deterrent against terrorists, or will the anger of displaced families of Rafah create more problems for the Egyptian government? Karim Gamaletin, Press TV, Cairo.
She served as the people's lawyer for decades, winning high-profile cases that embarrassed government prosecutors, cases that often put the entire U.S. criminal justice system on trial. Lynn Stewart was chosen as a target by the Bush administration's U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft shortly after the September 11, 2001 attacks. She was prosecuted for violating special government restrictions, forbidding her from communicating with the press on her client's behalf. After years of courtroom battles, she was convicted of various charges of conspiracy and providing material support to terrorists, namely her client, the blind cleric Abdel Rahman. After more court wrangling, she was sentenced to 10 years in prison and served about 4 years and 2 months before being released for her declining health a year ago last week. To mark the passing of her first year out of prison, Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford conducted an in-depth interview with the people's lawyer, Lynn Stewart, about the grand jury system in the U.S. in the wake of several controversial findings by American grand juries.
The grand jury is really the star chamber of our day. If I can use that analogy, you know, the star chamber, which basically just convicted people in old England and set off with your head. Of course, it was born out of great discontent on the part of the nobles. Nobles only, men, white, old, privileged, who were being thrown into jail by the king because he could just get rid of them that way. You know, goodbye, now I'll take your castle. So they revolted, and that revolt ended up with the Magna Carta, which, of course, people tout as being, you know, one of the beginning documents of liberty. But really, it was, once again, like all the other documents of liberty, liberty for a very limited few, and very limited liberty for them even. But now to have it transmogrified into being this vehicle by which we can seek justice against police who are literally murderers, as urged on by prosecuting officials, it really does smack. It's the most hypocritical in the extreme, because on the one hand it's saying we have to go after these guys and we're going to present this evidence to the grand jury, and on the other hand knowing that the way in which it's presented and by whom it's presented will mean that there'll be no voting of any kind of charges.
Yes, and in the grand jury proceeding, there is no presentation of what you call the opposition scenario, that is, the scenario of the defendant.
Exactly. A defendant may appear, of course, as I said in my short piece, in our cases, the tragedy is the defendants are dead. They're not able to appear and tell their side of the story, even if they were permitted. But where those rare occasions where defendants do appear, they are only permitted to present their position. Their lawyer is not permitted to take any active part whatsoever. In other words, he can't stay in the grand jury room and cross-examine witnesses after the DA. That is verboten. And if you want to do that, counselor, you'll have to go to trial. Well, that's what should happen, in my view.
And, of course, the grand jury is a tool of the prosecutor in a national security state such as the one we live under now. Grand juries have been used with vicious effect on the opposition, on progressives, on those who oppose the national security state and imperial wars.
No question about it, Glenn. And, you know, we all have our worst-case scenarios. What's the worst case? One of the ones I hold so close to my heart was the murder of two young men who were shot when they were face down in an apartment in the Bronx, and the grand jury came back with justifiable homicide. And that was made into a documentary showing all the proof that it was a homicide, but it sure wasn't justifiable. There are so many of these, and it goes back so far. And as I say, the grand jury is just another tool in their arsenal, as if they needed more. But it is another tool. It's an imprimatur. It's something that says, look, we're going by the law. Of course, so did the Nazis. Everything they did was according to law. And this is the same scenario. We're doing it according to the law. You can have no argument. And they expect people not to stand up and say, law, what law? You know, whose law? When was this law? You know, so definitely it's outside the realm.
Now, in St. Louis, the grand jury was a tool of the prosecutor, Bob McCullough, a tool for non-prosecution.
In the way the grand jury operates, there are grand juries and there are special grand juries. It's very interesting to me right now because, and I don't even know if I'm allowed to reveal this, but my granddaughter is sitting on a special grand jury and she has a billion questions, of course, about what she's doing because they have no idea. They just basically sit there and they roll this evidence past them. So then there's grand juries and they basically have traditionally in New York State anyway, and it's not used so much in every state, but New York State, it is the main way in which a defendant is brought before the court. And they basically just roll the cop in. The cop says, da 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 da, and cop talk, rolls out again, and then they take a vote, and they vote, you know, an indictment. And then that is what the person must answer to in front of a judge in a court of law. And that's when the trial process begins, or I should say the plea process, because there are no such thing as trials anymore. Everybody has to plead. Everybody gets a deal, so-called. But at any rate, what is so not remarkable, but so opprobrious about the process by which they present a case against a cop is that it's decided ahead of time that, of course, the cop will not be indicted, that, of course, it will not operate in the usual way, that is, he'll be brought on for trial, but that he will be exonerated either by reason of no true bill, meaning there's not enough evidence, or that it was justifiable, which is really a leap in most of these cases, absolutely.
As you describe it, it sounds to me like the grand jury is a bunch of citizens who are there simply to give legitimacy to the prosecutor.
I think you've nailed it, Glenn. That's exactly what it is. And also, up to the rest of us. The rest of us are then supposed to be able to say, well, they presented it to, what is it, 28 people, 24 people? It must be okay if they went along with it. They wouldn't have gone along. Sometimes we get this phenomenon, which hasn't been seen in a long time now, of, quote, a runaway grand jury. And the runaway grand jury takes the case from the prosecutor and starts going its own way, really evaluating evidence, really making decisions, really voting the way it should be voted. But that, as I say, is a phenomenon that hasn't happened, I would say, in the last 20 years.
You're advocating that the grand jury system should be abolished. Would it leave a hole or not?
Well, only if, you know, as I mentioned in my short piece, there are cases, and I've been fortunate enough to represent people on them, where the defendant's account of what happened, usually a self-defense case, where he says to the grand jury, look, this is what happened, I went this, and they vote against the prosecutor, they vote no true bill. So in those very rare occasions, I would say in my 30 years of practice, I can only remember two or three cases where that ever happened. There are some cases where they voted both ways. They voted what they would call up and down. In other words, I don't know whether anybody listening will remember the case of Yunus Muhammad, who was after our friend, in quotes, small letter, big F, Giuliani, made a speech against Dinkins, calling him a washroom attendant when he was mayor of the city. After Giuliani did that, this kid was on the subway, and he accidentally tripped a cop who was drunk and coming back from a rally. And this cop then, along with his buddies, beat this kid senseless. He was a very slight kid. You know, when I say slight, he was small. Anyway, to make a long story short, that particular case was presented to the grand jury. We presented our side, which we had witnessed in saying that the cops had hit first and that it was their badness. The cop attacked him. He retaliated with a box cutter. The box cutter gave the cop 130 stitches. The cops then dragged him off the subway, the Franklin Avenue shuttle, and bounced him down the stairs, head bouncing on each stair as he went down. He ultimately lost partial sight in one eye, and you can imagine his state the next day when we were called in to represent him. His jaws were wired. I mean, it was an awful beating, but we did put him in the grand jury, Yunus Muhammad, and the cop went in the grand jury too, and they both got indicted. Now, Yunus went to trial and ultimately ended up with a hung jury. The cop, he was not charged with serious felonies, whatever it was, nor were his buddies. But that was at least a fair presentation by the DA, because she presented both sides equally and asked the grand jury to decide who was the bad guy in this. And they said they both were bad. Which, of course, really was not true. But at any rate, that's another aspect. So when you say, do I think the grand jury should be abolished? I do. I think it's an anachronism. I think it puts another roadblock in the way of people looking at a case and deciding it. I think it's a way in which the prosecution has continued to keep the playing field, if you can call it that, and to some degree law and trial is a playing field. It's kept the playing field for itself. It controls all the moves. And one of those moves is certainly the grand jury. And to me, at least looking at the big picture of it all, it seems the grand jury should be abolished.
Going back to Missouri, Bob McCullough, the prosecutor, could convene another grand jury and have another swipe at former officer Darren Wilson. But I don't know if people would advocate that Bob McCullough be in charge of that process again. But what about the feds? What options do they have regarding Darren Wilson? Open to them right now.
Well, I think it's extremely interesting, and we've been watching it with interest. The grand juror who wants to be able to speak out, in other words, he wants to pierce the secrecy of the grand jury and say what really went on in there. And I think that's a very healthy sign, and we'll see whether or not in supposedly a system that's supposed to be open and honest, a court will sustain his request for that. That could be the beginning of the end of the grand jury if they do, if he is permitted to speak out. I doubt very much that the DA in St. Louis County will represent the case. He's where he wants to be. He's in the catbird seat. He has no desire to reopen this can of worms, believe you me. So he will sit pat unless something happens that forces his hand. And, you know, I don't see much out there. But you never can tell. That's what, so we live in interesting times, Glenn. May we live in interesting times.
Is there anything interesting that the federal government, the U.S. Justice Department, could do, not what it will do, but could do regarding Darren Wilson?
Well, the past has shown us that the federal government, while they have power to do things, they rarely seize that power. And I think that mainly any power they may have is just the power to continue to do wrong. They are not really suited to. They have brought, I will say, certainly there was a case of Anthony Baez in the Bronx, a young man who was playing football and the ball hit the cop car, and they ended up killing him. And his family did sue, and his mother is one of our big advocates against police brutality, Iris Baez. And they did win a federal lawsuit on basis that his civil rights had been denied. But when you start talking about civil rights, where someone has been murdered, you've already lost 10 steps. I'm sorry. It's just like going for the basket, you know. You're at half court and they're down under the basket. They're not going to pursue that in the same way they would pursue a true criminal prosecution. And so, yes, the federal government can do things. It has in the past, but rarely is it successful.
Is it rarely successful because of the obstacles, or is it rarely successful because of the will and resources that the federal government dedicates to it?
I think it's definitely both. I think it's difficult because, you know, at a certain point, people don't want to hear about this anymore. But I think it also is, this is not the case that's going to make a career for a young prosecutor. He's not going from here to some schmarmy Wall Street firm where he's going to be a big deal. You know, there's very few Ramsey Clarks left in our world that go forward and become more militant as they get older and older. So I think that it's both. It's a will on the part of the prosecutor's office plus the actual resources to do a case like that.
You, of course, have been a defender of the people, whether they are engaged in political pursuits or just going about their lives. Do you think that the lawyerly profession is more or less important today in terms of the politics of movements than it was in previous years, given that the political climate and the rules as laid down by the Supreme Court have changed?
You put me in a tough position, Glenn, because, you know, my restrictions being disbarred are probably some of the most opprobrious you can imagine. I'm not even allowed to go into my son and daughter's law offices and file papers for them. I have to stay away from all aspects of the law. I have basically interpreted that to mean, it doesn't mean commenting on what I think about the situation. And of course, I've been to many law schools and talked to young lawyers and urged them, you know, to stick with why they became lawyers, even in the face of what they're facing in terms of owing government, owing the banks, the banksters, this ton of money for being the privilege of becoming a lawyer. I think that there's still fire in the belly out there. There's still young people who want to do this work because they know it's the right thing to do, and they know if they don't do it, there's no one else that's going to do it. And that is very, very important. And, you know, it does range from people just fair beating on the subway to those who are murdering their hedge fund father. But the gamut of crime is very wide and is a real challenge to make sure that people get treated fairly, and particularly political people. And I think we're going to see more and more with the closing down now of Grand Central Station as a vicinage for people to put on a demonstration that is really paid attention to and noticed. And I think they're going to crack down on any kind of demonstration type things. And this, of course, I think is in response to the cops being mad at de Blasio. He's going to give them an inch there. So, listen, I think that the law today has a long way to go. I think that people, lawyers in particular, are frightened. I think my case scared an awful lot of people. Here was me just doing what I was supposed to be doing, and I ended up doing 5 years in jail. So there are all kinds of impediments, but I do know there are good people out there that continue to do the good thing, carry on the good fight, and I have faith that they will continue to do that.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.